Hello out there, my friends in audio land. This is Tim Benal, benalofamerica.com. Welcome to the October 1st, 2005 edition of Benal of America Audio Season 1. This week, we're speaking with Terry Hansen. He's the author of The Missing Times, News Media Complicity in the UFO Cover-Up. And you're going to hear me gush about the book in the interview, but it's all true. This is an amazing book. I highly recommend it. It's one of my favorites. I often go back and use it as a resource when I'm writing about various topics for benalofamerica.com. And as I point out later on in the interview as well, Terry Hansen has been a great help to benalofamerica.com throughout our growth. So it was really great to have a chance to speak with him. Here's a small bit of his bio from his website. He also gives us a lot of background about how he got into the whole UFO field. Terry Hansen's a former technical magazine editor and now an independent journalist with a special interest in scientific controversies and the politics of mass media. He has followed the UFO controversy for much of his life and has occasionally written about it for various media, including National Public Radio and the Minneapolis Star and Tribune. He has been a guest on various regional and national broadcast programs, including Dreamland, the History Channel, Coast to Coast AM, and Strange Days. He's also spoken before various groups about UFO-related censorship and propaganda. In addition, he has organized and moderated two symposiums about the science and politics of UFO research for the Science Museum of Minnesota in St. Paul, one of the nation's largest science museums. He holds a bachelor's degree in biology and a master's degree in science journalism, both from the University of Minnesota. He's a founding partner of KFH Publications, a Seattle computer magazine publishing company. And you can find out a lot more about him by listening to the rest of this interview or visiting his website, www.themissingtimes.com. This interview was conducted on August 11th, 2005. So let's rock and roll here. This interview was conducted on August 11th, 2005. Terry Hansen, News Media Complicity in the UFO Cover-Up, in depth.
I want to welcome you to another edition of Benal of America Audio. Let me tell you a little background on how I came to find out about this guest. I was at the X Conference in 2004 in Washington, D.C. I think it was Sunday afternoon, and I checked out Terry Hansen, and I was completely blown away. It was like a renewal of energy. I just sat there and learned so much, and I got the book when I came back to Boston, and the book is The Missing Times, News Media Complicity in the UFO Cover-Up. And Terry Hansen is an amazing individual. The book is fascinating. It's incredibly educational. I can't even stress that enough. It is just so, you learn so much from reading the book, and any serious student of ufology should already have read it, and if they haven't, they should be ordering it as they speak. And Terry Hansen has been really kind enough to correspond with me over the past few months, and when the ABC UFO special came out, he was the first guy I contacted, because when it comes to UFO coverage in the media, I can't think of any other person that I'd want to speak to more than him. So I'm incredibly psyched that we have the chance to talk to him and bring this audio to the benalofamerica.com visitors. And thank you very much, Terry Hansen. Thanks for coming to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
All right. Let me just kick it off with the first question here. Why don't you give me your background before you even decided to go along with this book?
Okay, well, my background is, my formal education, I should say, is in science and journalism. I have a degree in biology, a bachelor's of science degree in biology, and a master's of arts in science journalism from the University of Minnesota. So, I think my education reflects my interests as well as my working career, and that I have worked both in science and journalism. I started out working in medical research after I got out of college, and I gradually drifted toward getting various capacities. And after I went back to my graduate degree in journalism, I started working for a little computer magazine, and that became kind of a long occupation. I worked for various publishing companies for, I guess, maybe 15 or 20 years, and ended up starting a publishing company, which I was part owner, and I was worked for that company up until about, I guess, 6 years ago or so, like that.
All right.
Then I've been more or less semi-retired. I took time out to write the book. I spent about 2 years writing the book, and I've done some speaking, public speaking, and various other things related to that since.
Well, what made you all of a sudden decide to write a UFO book? Because that's an off-the-beaten-path sort of divergence.
I think my interest in it evolved gradually over time, because I was a biology student originally, and I was very interested in the issue of extraterrestrial life and the process of looking for signs of intelligent life. It seemed to me that UFOs were a natural topic that one had to take a look at as part of a general body of data that pertained to the subject. And it was very curious to me that there was a lot of resistance, or seemed to be a lot of resistance among the scientific community to taking the UFO data seriously, even though there was quite a lot of it if you really took time to review this topic. Initially, I thought that it was due just to the conservative nature of scientists generally, that they were, they're typically resistant to investigating anything that is surprising or unexpected. Scientists, as a number of sociologists have observed, tend to think they know what the world is like or how the world works, and when something is discovered that's completely contrary to their theories, they often tend to just ignore it for a long time before they get around to actually studying it. And I thought that was initially the response of scientists to UFOs, but over time I began to realize that there was another component to that, and that was that the government's policies to try to discourage interest in the subject, and then, of course, the news media as well, which tends to be a news media in the U.S., I think most big countries, tends to be an extension of the government in terms of what the positions they take and the information they transmit. So I just began looking into that more and more. I'd heard a number of UFO investigators comment that they thought the media was not investigating the subject or not reporting the subject accurately, and that they might even be under pressure or trying to censor the topic to some extent. And I was kind of curious about that, whether it was possible. So I began looking into the history of censorship in the United States going back to the beginning of the 20th century and moving forward to try to better understand the relationship between the media companies and the government. And what I discovered was that although the media companies would have us believe that they're very independent of the government, federal government, in fact, over the past 100 years or so, they've worked rather closely with the government, particularly during times of war, to propagandize the American public and keep them in a warlike state of mind. Most typically during World War I and World War II and then the Cold War. And since the UFO topic really became an issue at the end of World War II, it seemed possible that the media was playing a role in managing the UFO subject as well.
You make a point in the foreword of the book that it's not a conspiracy, really. It's more of a complicity, and that's how you phrase it in the title. And so what you're trying to really say is that it's not so much a situation of the government outright controlling the media, but it's a cooperative effort between the two bodies?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. You have to realize that particularly today, the big media companies tend to be wholly owned subsidiaries of large arms conglomerates. So that they have an interest in promoting war and keeping the public in a warlike state of mind. So in that sense, they're sort of looking after their own best interests by going along with whatever policies the military has. And I think that it was pretty clear if you go back to the early 40s and 50s that the UFO phenomenon initially was seen as a potential threat or a threat to national security, if you want to put it that way. Initially, the government didn't seem to know what was going on with UFOs. There were some people speculating that They were a Soviet weapon, Soviet secret weapon initially, and then later it became more obvious that they were probably extraterrestrial. But whatever the case, they were a threat because we didn't know what the UFOs were doing. They were displaying a lot of interest in our nuclear weapons R&D facilities, in our military bases, strategic areas such as ports, military, industrial manufacturing facilities, and so on. This was very clearly reflected in some of the early books of the day, particularly Ed Ruppel's book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, in which he very explicitly says that the UFOs were being seen mostly around strategically significant areas. Now, there were also other documents. There was a famous memo by H. Marshall Chadwell, who was a scientific intelligence officer reporting to the CIA in 1952, where he said that the UFOs were being observed near military facilities. So, obviously, anything, anytime your military facilities are under observation, whether it's from flying saucers or alien or a foreign aircraft or whatever, that's a military concern. So, right away, you have these concerns being expressed about a possible invasion scenario. And there was actually a denial on the front page of the New York Times by President Eisenhower in, I think it was 1956 or 1954, possibly, where Eisenhower made a public statement reassuring the public that the world was not being invaded from outer space. So it's rather remarkable in today's frame of reference. It's astonishing that a standing president, would have to make a statement like that to reassure the public. So, given that situation, you can see pretty clearly that the government would have had a rationale for managing how the public received the UFO phenomenon, particularly by censoring information about it, and also by injecting false and misleading information, what we know as propaganda, into the media about the topic. We also know that the Central Intelligence Agency got involved in 1953 because there's something called the Robertson Panel report, and the Robertson Panel concluded that UFOs, or the reporting of UFOs, was a threat to national security, and therefore the public should be educated, as they put it, through a program of training and debunking. And this was to involve use of leading news organizations, popular public figures, entertainment companies such as the Walt Disney Company, and generally all the propaganda apparatus that had been used so successfully in World War II. The CIA's official position is that none of this ever took place, but if you actually go back and review the subject, if you review the media's behavior and other evidence that relates to this, there's a very strong case that, in fact, it was carried out and probably is still being carried out today.
In the book, you cover a ton of various aspects of censorship and propaganda. So can you just touch on those two means and methods, because there's a lot of stuff you cover under that.
Okay, sure. I spent about two chapters. I leave the subject altogether for two chapters and just review the history of censorship and propaganda in the United States. Now, we're often told or led to believe that the U.S. government does not use propaganda. Well, nothing can be further from the truth. The U.S. is a very skilled and sophisticated user of propaganda and has used it extensively since World War I and particularly since World War II and the Cold War era. And I think it's still very heavily in use today in the so-called War on Terror. But basically, when you're trying to manipulate public opinion, you do it, it's kind of a two-step process. The first thing is censorship. You close off the public's knowledge of what's actually going on. And there are many different ways of doing that, but basically once you've blocked off the public access to the real world, then you can create an artificial world, or what's called a pseudo-reality, or a pseudo-environment, to replace that picture, the real world picture So that's the role of propaganda, is to create that pseudo-environment. Now, historically, going back to World War I, the government has actually looked to the big media companies to help them do this, both in terms of censoring the news and also in terms of creating propaganda. And typically, the government tries to find leading journalists and media executives to staff its censorship and propaganda operation. This is sort of contrary to what many people might believe about the news business. You would think that journalists would not want to do this. It would be kind of professionally dishonest for them to engage in these types of undertakings. But in fact, they're very willing to do that. And it's just like any other job. They're happy to work for the government as much as, say, the New York Times. And sometimes there's no difference between the New York Times and the government. They're following exactly the same agenda. So that's kind of an overview of how media-government relationship evolved. World War II, there were actually two large bureaucracies, one to handle censorship, one to handle propaganda, and those large bureaucracies were staffed almost entirely by journalists and media executives, and there really wasn't much difference between the Pentagon and the media business during World War II. They were fighting the same war, they were all on the same side, and they pretty much agreed that censorship and propaganda were essential to winning the war. Now, after World War II and the Cold War era began, these attitudes really didn't change any. Big media companies continued to be very cozy with the CIA and the military and do favors and censor news and check propaganda and so forth. So when the UFO issue developed, it was sort of natural that the CIA would think of using media companies to help manage public opinion about UFOs, and that's exactly what happened.
Now, what do you have? It's mostly anecdotal evidence for the government and media UFO collusion, except for the CBS-CIA panel document. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, because I found that to be really fascinating.
Okay, well, my approach to the subject of UFO-related censorship propaganda really is kind of theoretical in that I said, well, if you hypothesize that UFOs are a national security issue, then it would follow that the government would want to manage public opinion about it, because that's exactly what they've done in other similar circumstances. I didn't really know whether I would turn up any direct evidence, documentary evidence for this, because typically these types of operations are very highly classified, and often the documentation is destroyed after the fact so that there's no paper trail to indicate how the government undertook its campaign. But I was discussing this sort of theoretical framework with Michael Swords, who's a sociologist at, I think it's Western Michigan University, if I'm not mistaken. And he had uncovered a personal letter between Thornton Page, who had been a member of the CIA's Robertson panel in 1953, and secretary of the Robertson panel. Escapes me for a minute here. Don't come to me. At any rate, Page in this letter, a personal letter written on a train, evidently, longhand, and he confesses that he helped organize the CBS TV show around the Robertson panel conclusions. Well, the date of this letter was just after CBS had broadcast a very high-profile program called UFOs, Friend, Foe, or Fantasy. It was narrated by Walter Cronkite, and the program was full of false and misleading information. It was very... It was a work of propaganda, even from an objective outsider's point of view. I mean, it was demonstrably misleading. And it followed very closely the recommendations of the Robertson panel, but I never really expected that I would find documentation tying the two together. But when Swords found this letter, it sort of clinched it, that indeed this was part of the CIA's Robertson panel effort, and it was... The letter was written in 1966, which is about 13 years after the Robertson panel made its recommendation. Now, a skeptic might say, well, you just have that one documentation, one bit of documentation, that doesn't really approve it doesn't really prove that the whole program was carried out, but if you stop and think about it, what is the likelihood that the CIA would wait 13 years before implementing the Roberts panel's conclusions, do it once with a major TV network, and then stop doing it? And what's even more or less likely, I should say, is that we would find the one bit of documentary evidence proving that this event took place. It's, you know, from a purely probability point of view, if you think about it, it's much more likely that the program was underway throughout that 13-year period, and probably still is, and that because of the CIA's very careful guidelines to, you know, keep this kind of activity covert, there really wasn't, we haven't found any other evidence other than this one letter. And typically, a propaganda campaign will not work if you're just working with one broadcast outlet or one media organization. You have to be working with a broad range of publications and broadcast outlets in order for the program to work. Otherwise, CBS would have been conspicuously different from all the other news sources in the way it's been reporting the UFO topic, and that's not the case. They've all been pretty much been singing the same tune. So I don't think that that's an accident. Now, you can take that a little bit further to look at some of the other organizations that were known or are well documented and have even admitted to have worked with the CIA during this period, one of which is the New York Times. The publisher of the New York Times, Arthur Sulzberger, had a very close relationship with the CIA, and his attitude was reportedly to help the CIA whenever it wanted help. And indeed, there was actually a content analysis done on New York Times coverage of the UFO topic that showed it became progressively more negative over time toward the UFO subject. So it's almost as if, you know, its editorial stance fell into line with what the CIA wanted. Exactly. And of course, if you're familiar with the infamous University of Colorado investigation, the Condon Commission, as it was known, that came out in paperback form. It was basically endorsed by Walter Sullivan, who was the New York Times science writer. So even though it was an extremely controversial investigation, it had a lot of serious problems with it, a lot of internal dissent and, you know, methodological problems and so forth, the New York Times gave it its stamp of approval right away. The New York Times also fell into line with CBS and other big media companies in endorsing Hynek's swamp gas case when the rest of the media, national media, was kind of laughing at the idea. So the New York Times and CBS particularly have been pretty much marching in league with the CIA's desires on this issue. And there's a lot of other arguments I could make along those lines, but essentially it really adds up to a pretty strong case that the Robertson Panel program was a broad-based program that involved some of the leading news organizations in the country.
Let's go through a hypothetical situation, like a UFO incident occurs, just like the Phoenix Lights, or, you know, any something like that. How is the media response indicative of their collusion with the government?
Okay, well, there's two things that are significant, I think, if you study the coverage of an incident like that. UFO sightings, when they take place, are usually reported accurately and honestly by the regional news media. So if you happen to live in Phoenix or Montana or somewhere where there's a major UFO flap, you can read about it. It'll be in the papers. They're pretty conscientious about reporting the story. But the story seems to end there. It doesn't go out on the wire services. It is not picked up by the network affiliates. Freelance writers have difficulty placing stories about it in the national press and so forth. So what seems to happen is an embargo takes place on that story to keep it trapped in that region. And the national media just basically turn a blind eye to this. So you've got two worldviews being presented by the media. The regional grassroots media is reporting UFO stories, but the national media is scoffing at it and just generally not reporting it at all. It does sometimes surface at the national level, but very rarely, and usually the coverage dies down very quickly after the incident takes place. There's very little follow-up or curiosity at the national level.
What do you think some of the methods being used are in this collusion between the media and the government? what are the various ways they're going about doing this? In the censorship propaganda realm, what are the different sorts of things we can you'd see and you'd say, you know, that's a sign that something's going on here?
Okay, well, on the censorship side, the way censorship has worked in the past is, you know, it's a multi-level process. You have initially the military, which orders its personnel not to talk about something that has occurred. So if there's a sighting near a military base, people are called in and they're told in no uncertain terms that they are never, ever to discuss the subject, period. And most of them take this pretty seriously. So that's what's called censorship at source. And naturally, if someone from the media were to call up and ask about an event or whatever, they wouldn't get much cooperation from the military. Now, another level is that historically, the big media companies have willingly cooperated with the national security state on national security issues, so that if, say, the president or director of the CIA or whoever calls up the publisher of the New York Times and says, look, this is a very important issue. We don't want the public to know about this. They're quite willing to censor the story. They'll pull their reporters off the story and make sure that it doesn't get any coverage. So that there are these kind of cooperative relationships, and this has been documented many, many times outside the UFO topic. So it's reasonable to assume that also goes on with UFOs. Now, another way is that the wire services have a long working relationship with the national security establishment, so that they are willing not only to censor certain kinds of stories, but also to inject propaganda directly into the newspapers via the wire services. This was demonstrated back just fairly recently. I don't have the exact date, but there was a story in the New York Times about the CIA's propaganda plans during the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. And the CIA had an agreement with UPI and AP to inject propaganda stories directly onto the wires. This was reported by Tim Weiner, who's a pretty good reporter. He used to wrote a book called Blank Check, and then later went on to work for the New York Times. Well, suspected that they might have hired him so they could keep a closer eye on him. But anyway, the long and short of it is that the wire services do have these formal relationships, and they go back quite a long way to World War II, and I think they're still very much intact today. I think the military recognizes that it's essential to be able to control news at the national level. What are some of the other methods? Well, of course, people are often threatened. They're often ridiculed. In fact, that's been a major way of keeping the UFO topic out of the press, is to make people feel silly about reporting something that they do. No one wants to be laughed at. And if you're made a laughing stock for reporting a UFO sighting, the signal goes out to everyone else in the community that you're not going to gain much by reporting your sighting. So those are just a few examples. There are others that are even more clever and sophisticated. And I could talk about some of those too.
We'll save those for the people that buy the book. You know, I think, there's tons of them in there. We could talk all night about it, about those. You know, that's one of my favorite parts of the book is we don't need to give it all away. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But that's one of the highlights of the book for me, so I would highly recommend that part to be checked out. Moving on to the very end of the book is The Journalist's Guide to Covering the UFO Controversy. That's the appendix. Tell me a little bit about that, because I think that should be read by just about everybody who's writing about UFOs and covering the UFO phenomenon, because it was very educational and gave some sage advice.
All right. Well, yeah, that was one of the things that I hope I could contribute to the journalism profession is provide some guide, advice to people who are trying to cover a story like this. I just did an interview, an email interview, I should say, with a newspaper in Illinois. And what I told her was that this is an extremely complex topic. You have to know the history of the subject going back about 60 years to really understand it. And that generally any kind of scientific controversy is very complex, sociologically complex. And there are many forces at play in sort of managing or trying to manage the topic. One factor is that the scientific community is not, they depend pretty heavily on the Pentagon for most of their research. Most scientific research in the U.S. is sponsored by the federal government, and most of that research is sponsored by the Pentagon, and often has a qualification for getting Pentagon contracts and so forth. Scientists have to sign away their traditional rights and freedoms. They may sign secrecy agreements and that sort of thing. And that really puts them in a different camp. It almost splits the scientific community into what I call public science and private science. There's public science is what you read about in journals like Science and Nature or New Scientist, research that is done, publicly funded, and then openly published. But there's a lot of science that doesn't get published at all, that's born classified, to use the expression. And it remains classified as long as the national security state decides to keep it that way. And there are documents going back to World War I that are still classified today. And the United States government is a very secretive organization with many, many compartments and bureaus of intelligence. And they all harbor large volumes, literally trillions of pages of documents that are classified and often remain that way for many, many decades. So that's part of it. And I think you also have to understand that there is, again, a tendency of scientists to want to reject things that are maybe seem a little bit outlandish or fantastic. So a lot of UFO reports, as Dr. J. Allen Hynek put it, have what's called high strangeness. They're really very unusual. They don't really fit into our normal framework. And I think the tendency of scientists often is to reject them just because they are strange, just because they don't fit. But I think you have to take exactly the opposite tack and recognize that if they are evidence of advanced intelligence, then they probably would be rather strange events because, as Arthur C. Clarke, a famous science fiction writer, put it, he said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So what he's saying there was that, you know, a very advanced technology is not going to be easily understood by us. It is very much more advanced than what we have.
Let's move on to the next section, because that sort of covers a lot of the book stuff. Now I sort of want your opinion on other media matters in the UFO field and that kind of thing. Starting with, what did you think of the Mexican UFO footage that came out last year and the coverage of it in the U.S.? I saw it was covered it got maybe 5 minutes on Fox with Shepard Smith, and I'm sure it got a few minutes on CNN and some of the cable outlets, but I'm sure you probably saw some of that. So what did you think of the coverage that it managed to get?
Yeah, I remember that. I don't know if I saw any of the television coverage of it. It did get quite a bit of coverage initially, because there was, you know, actual photographs, which always is a little more difficult to debunk than just eyewitness testimony. But typically, it kind of goes through a cycle. You know, initially there's a little bit of questions asked about it, and then someone comes out with an explanation, such as they were, you know, infrared flares or whatever. And then that becomes the accepted explanation, and the story sort of dies away.
All right, so we talked a little bit last February by email about the ABC UFO special. It's been about almost 6 months since that aired. What's your reflection on it now? I mean, we talked, it was practically less than 3 or 4 days after it aired, so I'm sure you've had a lot of time now to look back on it and maybe do a little investigation. So what did you think?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of speculation prior to the broadcast that ABC might be breaking ranks and, you know, going to do something new and exciting, but I was a little skeptical that they would, and it was pretty much what I expected. I mean, they interviewed a lot of people, they had a lot of material. They could have blown the issue wide open, but they chose not to do that. They took a conservative approach, and they only used some of the less sensational material. And they came down particularly hard on the Roswell case, as you probably know.
Yeah.
And in thinking about this, you know, after several months, that's what really jumps out at me about the program in general. It seemed like The whole thing was designed to tuck people in, give them a little bit of intriguing information so that they build the audience, and then, once the audience is there, come down hard and just totally destroy the Roswell case. And this seemed to me to be fairly transparent in the sense that this is exactly what the military has been trying to do for some years now. As you know, they periodically always come out with another explanation of what the Roswell event was all about.
Yeah.
There have been multiple explanations, each a little bit different from the others, that are sort of designed to match the latest information that's come out. And I think the Roswell case is a kind of a political hot potato for the government. There's been a lot of pressure from the constituents, senators and congressmen, to find out what that was all about. Representative Stephen Schiff actually began to make some inquiries about it, as you probably remember. So it's been a problem for the Pentagon to explain away the Roswell case. And I, in my opinion, that was probably the main purpose of this broadcast, was to try to come down and debunk the Roswell case once and for all, because it is such a politically difficult thing for the government. Now, I personally believe the Roswell incident was an extraterrestrial craft of some type. There's a great deal of evidence from many different quarters to support that conclusion. But it's an important case because it indicates that the government has had physical evidence since the late 1940s, and if this were ever to become accepted by the public, that would pretty much be the end of the controversy. And actually, if you look at the public opinion polls, I think the public has by and large accepted that that fact already, that the majority of Americans do think that there is, the U.S. government is hiding this kind of knowledge.